On Sunday, November 3rd, at the historic Hollywood Theater, KABU presents an exclusive benefit screening of the film KPFA On the Air.
This documentary tells the powerful story of the beginnings of listener-sponsored radio in the United States with the birth of Pacifica in Berkeley in 1949.
KPFA On the Air chronicles the origins of the free speech movement, the first stirrings of the student movements at Berkeley, and opposition to the Vietnam War in the early 1960s.
Eventually spawning a network of free-form, independent radio stations across the country, including KABU, which came on the air in 1968. So come join us at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard, Sunday, November 3rd, at 7 in the evening.
Help keep community radio strong and thriving into the future.
Muertos Northwest invites you to the 5th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration, Saturday, November 2nd, at the Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street, Portland, under the Hawthorne Bridge. Celebration of life and death. Come help the spirits of your loved ones return with their favorite food, drinks, and plenty of dancing. Bring an item to add to the community altar. Muertos face painting for the young and old, sugar skull decorating, hot chocolate and pan dulce will be served. Come check out Mariachi Portland, Conjunto Alegre, and Rafa and the Deadliest Catch Band. Come for the Muertos, stay for the food, drinks, and dancing. Sponsored in part by KABU, Tequila Cuervo, and Cover Oregon. Visit Facebook Muertos Northwest.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Political Perspectives, and coming up on this program, we'll hear from investigative journalist Eric Schlosser, who'll be talking about his new book, Command and Control. Later in the hour, we'll hear from activist and author Madia Benjamin speaking about what must the movement against drones do to succeed. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, news, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a special report from the streets of Santa Rosa, California, where thousands of people, mostly Latino youth, took to the streets yesterday to protest the police killing of 13-year-old Andy Lopez. And at 11, we'll hear a program from Radio EcoShock on climate catastrophe past and future with Peter Ward on four past extinctions from global warming and on how rising seas will change America forever. And thank you, KABU members, for your generous support in our fall membership drive. You make this station possible.
I'm glad that the previous speakers, one talked about the...
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KABU Public Affairs. My guest is award-winning journalist Eric Schlosser, author of the New York Times bestsellers Fast Food Nation and Reefer Madness. His new book is Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. How safe are America's nuclear arsenals? What risk do they currently pose for us and for the world? These questions might have faded from the foreground in recent years, but Command and Control makes the reader think about them again. In Command and Control, Eric Schlosser provides a detailed look at a terrible accident in Damascus, Arkansas in 1980. At the same time, he provides a history of the U.S. nuclear weapons program, including the human errors, accidents, and near misses we probably heard little about. Eric Schlosser, thanks for coming into KABU to talk about this.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, I grew up in the Cold War, and when I was at college, I studied game theory and nuclear weapon strategy. And yet I really stopped thinking about nuclear weapons. It was after I wrote Fast Food Nation, and I was spending time in Colorado Springs with the Air Force, and Fast Food Nation opens with a visit to one of these top-secret Air Force installations inside Cheyenne Mountain, which was designed to protect our early warning system from a nuclear strike. So I was spending time with the Air Force, and I was interested in the future of warfare in space, because that's where the Air Force Space Command is headquartered and the U.S. Space Command. But the more time I spent with these officers, the more interested I became in nuclear weapons, not space weapons, because many of the officers I was spending time with had served in missile launch crews during the Cold War, and they started telling me stories about nuclear weapons. And then they told me the story of this one accident involving a nuclear weapon in Damascus, Arkansas, in September of 1980. And the details were just extraordinary to me. I was stunned I'd never heard about it. And the more I heard about it, the more I was determined to write about it someday. So I set out to write a relatively short book, which would have been a minute-by-minute unfolding of this serious weapons accident in rural Arkansas. But the more I learned about the subject, the more I realized that there was a lot that hadn't been told, that the threat was actually much greater than I had anticipated, and the book got bigger.
And the missile that you're talking about, it might be good, the accident and the missile that caused it,
yeah.
It might be good to kind of describe that, because that was very illuminating to me, to
yeah.
actually try to picture this whole situation where this incident happened.
Well, here's the story I was told, and the story that I felt like I needed to follow up. There was a repairman working in a missile silo in Damascus, Arkansas, about an hour or so outside of Little Rock. And he was working on a Titan II missile. Routine maintenance. The Titan II was the biggest intercontinental ballistic missile the United States ever deployed. It was more than 100 feet tall, about the size of a 10-story building, 25 feet in diameter. Very impressive weapon. And on top of it was an even more impressive weapon. The warhead on that one Titan II in that missile silo in Damascus, Arkansas, that one warhead was three times more powerful than all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War, including both atomic bombs. Three times more powerful. Most powerful warhead the United States ever put on a missile. So this repairman is doing routine maintenance. He's standing on a steel platform near the top of the missile, and the socket falls off of the wrench he's using, the wrench handle. The socket hits the steel work platform, bounces. He grabs for it, just misses it, and then the socket falls through a narrow gap between the steel work platform and the missile. Socket falls about 70 feet or so, ricochets off the silo, and then hits the missile and pierces a hole in the missile's skin. And suddenly, thousands of gallons of highly toxic, highly flammable, highly explosive rocket fuel are pouring into the missile silo. And the Air Force doesn't know what to do, because nothing like this has ever happened before. And it's an extraordinary story of the effort to save the missile and prevent it from exploding with this warhead on it. Now, one of the reasons we don't know this story is it was a news story at the time for a day or two in 1980, but the Air Force vehemently denied there was any possibility that this warhead could detonate. And I started doing more investigation. I interviewed former nuclear weapons designers from our weapons labs, one of whom had worked on this warhead. It became clear to me that this nuclear warhead could have detonated during this accident. And then I was able later to find out there had been a study done just 3 years before this accident at one of our weapons labs. The study listed the nuclear weapons that had real safety problems, and this warhead was at the top of the list of the warheads lacking adequate safety devices. So it may not be shocking now, but the government wasn't telling the truth. And it wasn't telling the truth about one of the most powerful weapons the United States has ever built that literally could have incinerated much of the state of Arkansas. Mm-hmm. So a parallel narrative then appeared in the book. One is the story, minute by minute, of young airmen, 19, 20, 21 years old, risking their lives to try to prevent this missile from exploding. And the other narrative is the story, really since the dawn of the atomic era, to control our nuclear weapons, to make sure they don't detonate by accident, to make sure they can't be stolen or used by unauthorized personnel within our own military. And that was another real risk, and that was something else that the government was less than truthful about. I was at a screening last night of Dr. Strangelove, and the Air Force absolutely denied that anything like what happens in Strangelove, a rogue general deliberately starting World War III, could occur. And the reality is, almost a decade after Dr. Strangelove was released in 1964, it was still possible for a bomber crew, an American bomber crew, to fly to the Soviet Union if they wanted to and drop their hydrogen bombs, because there were no coded locks on those bombs, and there were no coded locks on our intercontinental ballistic missiles until the early 1970s. So because of military discipline and because of the screening procedures of the Air Force, none of our airmen and none of our missile crews ever launched without permission, but they could have. And it's significant, and it's a sign of how tenuous our grasp of these nuclear weapons were for most of the Cold War.
Yeah, I thought of the film Dr. Strangelove as I was reading the book. There is a part of the book where you do talk about Dr. Strangelove a little bit, but the parallels seemed pretty obvious, you know, as reading it, which is crazy in some ways. And other movies, too, that there were parallels to.
And, you know, the movies, another movie was Failsafe with Henry Fonda, president, you know, having to decide whether to trade an American city for a Soviet city because in order to prevent World War III, those films actually were accurate in saying an American bomber crew could go rogue and decide to attack the Soviet Union. In the book I write about how a German, you know, fighter pilot could have just gone rogue and dropped an atomic bomb on the Soviet Union because there were no locks on the bomb. But the films were inaccurate in one disturbing sense. In both films, there's a hotline where the head of the Soviet Union and the President of the United States are able to get on the phone and negotiate. And in reality, there was no hotline. There was no hotline during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And the book that Dr. Strangelove is based on, the book was called Red Alert, and it was about a rogue officer trying to deliberately start World War III. It was that book that inspired people in the Pentagon to even create a hotline. So, you know, things were very, very dangerous in the Cold War. And we came close on a number of occasions to having American nuclear weapons detonate accidentally on American soil. And we came close on a number of occasions to having an inadvertent war with the Soviet Union.
Do you think that the Damascus accident is the closest we came to having a major, major accident?
You know, there were quite a few of them. I wouldn't say that it was the closest that we came to having a detonation. The reason I chose it as the central narrative is that in that story and the way it unfolded are implicit many of the central themes of the book, which are about the great difficulty of controlling complex technologies. And again, you see relatively trivial minor events. The guy dropped a socket, having effects that were totally unanticipated and impossible to control. Now, I interviewed a lot of Titan II missile repairmen. They said you could have sat on that steel work platform and dropped the socket 1,000 times trying to hit the missile, and you couldn't have hit the missile. So this was, on the one hand, a one in a million type of accident. But again and again, you see small, strange accidents like that causing much more serious ones. I write about in the book, there was a guy doing repairs at a Minuteman missile silo. There was problems with the intruder alarm system. So he was working in the fuse box of the intruder alarm, and instead of using a fuse puller, he was using a screwdriver to pull out a fuse, reinsert a fuse. He did it a number of times. And then something happened and he caused a short circuit. And the retro rockets of the warhead on the missile fired. And the reentry vehicle containing the warhead lifted up in the air and then fell all the way down to the bottom of a silo. Now, you wouldn't think that would happen when you're trying to fix a burglar alarm, basically, an intruder alarm. But these are unbelievably complex technological systems. And one of the things I found is that we're a lot better at building these systems than we are at managing or controlling them.
And even within the Damascus accident, there's an interesting aspect to a small action, and there's some kind of dispute over whether one of these men who went in to try to make some kind of contact after this accident started, whether they were told to turn on the air conditioning or not, but they did, and that precipitated the large explosion that happened.
Yeah. there were so many levels of mismanagement of that accident, of a lack of command and control. And in that case, these young men were put into an extraordinarily dangerous environment. The fuel vapor concentrations in the air had gotten so high that you could maybe even move your hand through the air and detonate the fuel vapor. And the communications were terrible. The radio broadcasts between the upper leadership and the men on the ground weren't encrypted. There were dead spots on the site. I can go through so many errors. They didn't have maps of the area when they wanted to evacuate the local townspeople and the farms. Instructions were misunderstood and misheard. And, you know, this isn't like problems at your local auto dealership. These are problems involving a 9-megaton thermonuclear weapon that, 9 megatons, that's 600 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. Hugely, yeah. hugely yeah. More powerful.
And, you know, another thing that strikes me is just the location of these storage sites. I just didn't realize at these sort of semi-rural locations where a lot of these are located, what dangers people in the area were in. And it seems like so many of these accidents impacted small towns or small, you know, rural areas without urban people being aware.
Yeah. When you think about where to put an intercontinental ballistic missile with the most powerful warhead we ever built, the foothills of the Ozarks wasn't necessarily a great place. These missile silos for the Titan II were put in areas with local farms, little towns nearby. Out west, you know, in the Dakotas, a lot of the missile silos are in areas that are largely unpopulated. So if there's an accident of this type, you know, you're not having to evacuate the local elementary school, as they did have to do with some of the missiles in Arkansas. There was a congressman, Wilbur Mills, who was head of the House Ways and Means Committee from Arkansas, and he got these missiles to the state because it was a kind of pork. It was federal spending in his state. One of the things I was surprised at is how widely dispersed nuclear weapons were throughout the United States, not just at air bases in so many states and not just at intercontinental ballistic missile sites, but we also had nuclear-tipped anti-aircraft missiles outside major cities of the United States. And handling problems with these weapons jeopardized major American cities. Mm-hmm. Again and again, I heard from people who served in the Cold War that we can thank the technological competence of the United States. We can thank the training and the heroism of the servicemen who risked their lives to protect the country and to prevent nuclear catastrophes. But there was also a fair amount of good luck and just amazingly good fortune that one of these things didn't detonate.
I'm speaking with Eric Schlosser about his new book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. The period that you wrote about and the kind of thing that we're talking about with the end of the Soviet Union and various events, what happened to the kind of missiles and nuclear weapons that we're talking about?
Thankfully, there have been huge cutbacks in the arsenals of the United States and Russia, which inherited the Soviet arsenal. At the peak of the arms race in the early 1960s, the United States had 32,000 nuclear weapons, most of them more powerful than the weapon that destroyed Hiroshima. And a few years later after that, the Soviets eventually had about 35,000 nuclear weapons. And we've had major arms control agreements signed. It's interesting that the biggest cutbacks in our nuclear arsenal have been done by Republican presidents, not by Democrats, particularly by George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. So the numbers vary, but right now the United States has on alert you know, operational warheads about 1,600, and the Soviet Union has about 1,400. Each side has a few thousand being held in reserve. Those numbers are way too high, but they do reflect huge cutbacks from the era of the Cold War. What's disturbing today is how many other countries are seeking to obtain nuclear weapons, and particularly the arms race between India and Pakistan, which is mimicking our Cold War arms race, but is doing so between countries that really hate one another and our neighbors. I mean, the Soviet Union and the United States greatly disliked one another, but it was mainly an ideological difference. It was a kind of a global power politics rivalry. There's something about the hatred between neighbors that's more intense. And many of your listeners know about a neighbor that they really couldn't get along with at one point in their lives. And when you look at India and Pakistan, they're not only neighboring countries, they have strong religious and ethnic differences. And the margin of error is so much smaller because in the Cold War, if the Soviet Union launched a missile at the United States, it would take about a half hour to get here. Shorter if they launched it from a submarine, but most of their missiles were in the Soviet Union. So with a half hour, if the American president was told there was something disturbing on the radar, there might be some time to figure out, is this an attack or is this a false alarm? Between India and Pakistan, when the flight time of a missile is 5 or 6 minutes, once one side thinks they're under attack, the pressure to launch immediately will be enormous, and the possibility of a mistake becomes even greater. At the end of the book, I also talk about how I think we probably build the safest nuclear weapons. We invented this technology. We perfected it. And if we've had the number of close calls that we've had, think about countries like India, Pakistan, Russia, and their rate of industrial accidents. So we want as few of these nuclear weapons in the world as possible, in as few hands as possible. I think our president is terrific in suggesting the abolition of nuclear weapons. But until that day comes, we need to make sure there are as few as possible. And in terms of our arsenal, if we're going to have these weapons, we need to invest in making sure that they're safe, in making sure that the people who are maintaining them are well-trained and well-paid and highly motivated, because the consequences of one of these accidents is just too much to bear.
What is the safety status, or how do they compare the warheads that you mentioned now compared to what was happening at the time of the Titan II?
Yeah. One of the heroes of my book is an engineer at the Sandia National Laboratory, Robert Purifoy, Bob Purifoy, who became concerned about the threat of nuclear weapons accidents in the late 1960s and fought a bureaucratic battle of incredible proportions for about 20 years to get modern safety devices on our weapons. Now, you'd think that's a no-brainer, but there was incredible resistance from the military that didn't want anything in the weapon that might make the weapon less reliable. So today, thanks largely to this one engineer, Bob Purifoy, our weapons and our bombs are much safer, with much more modern safety devices than were on that warhead at the Damascus accident. Unfortunately, our bombs and our warheads are now mated to very complex weapons systems that may be less safe. And one of the things that was going on in 1980 with the Titan II missile is that it was an obsolete weapon system. It was supposed to be retired in the late 1960s. It was kept on alert long past when it should have been taken out of service. Right now in the United States, our Minuteman III missiles, our land-based missiles, were put into the ground in the early 1970s. They were supposed to be retired in the 1980s, so they're 40 years old. No B-52 bomber has been built since 1962, and they're our principal nuclear bomber. So, you know, the youngest one of them is 50, 51 years old. Some of them are 60 years old. And the basic infrastructure, the command and control infrastructure, the communications lines, the testing equipment, they're getting very old. And I'm not advocating a massive reinvestment in our nuclear weapons, but if we're going to have these things, we got to make sure they're safe. And this summer, two of our three strategic missile wings managing our Minuteman missiles were cited for serious safety violations. A few years ago, the Air Force's largest storage facility for nuclear weapons. The whole squadron that runs it was decertified for safety violations, and this should be of great concern to us.
And the computer systems that we all work with now, does that make missiles safer, or how does it relate to the whole system?
It's a source of great concern. I mean, even the greatest brand new Apple laptop freezes, has glitches, and it's a real hassle. But there are no nuclear weapons involved. We had a situation in 2010 at F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming in which 50 Minuteman missiles suddenly went offline. And what that meant was that the underground launch control centers could no longer communicate with their missiles. They were offline for an hour. And it was later discovered that there was a computer chip that was improperly installed in a processor that put the missiles offline. The Air Force at the time vehemently denied there was any possibility that someone had hacked into the system. But privately, some top Air Force officials became concerned about the ability of someone to hack into our nuclear command and control system. Now, that sounds like the plot of a Hollywood film. The Defense Science Board issued a report this year saying that the vulnerability of our nuclear command and control system to cyber attack has never been fully assessed. And when there were Senate hearings this spring on the issue, the head of the United States Strategic Command, the general responsible for all of our nuclear warheads, told the Senate he felt confident that the system was secure, and then he said, but we don't know what we don't know. And when he was asked, well, could someone hack into the Russian or the Chinese nuclear command and control systems and launch a missile by hacking? His answer was, Senator, I don't know. Now, this is a serious issue of concern. What Snowden and his revelations have showed us is that there's the potential of people within our own system to get into these computer networks. There are private contractors working on the nuclear command and control system. And I'm not saying one of them is going to launch one of our missiles, and this isn't necessarily a huge immediate threat, but it wouldn't take much once you got into that system to disable the missiles, to mess around with targeting, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the danger never went away when the Cold War ended. It was just largely forgotten. And the book does not argue one point of view about what we should do with our nuclear weapons strongly. It's not a five-point plan for a future nuclear strategy. It's just a reminder that thousands of these weapons still exist. They have destructive force that's almost unimaginable. And the American people need to think about these issues and educate themselves on these issues. So much of the information in my book was deliberately suppressed by the government. And when the government keeps this information away from the people, it allows a small group of policymakers in Washington, D.C. to make all the decisions on this issue. And I think the American people need to be the ones ultimately making these decisions. And there's just, as I've said earlier, there's been this historical amnesia and forgetting, and we need to confront the reality of these weapons and make sure none of them are ever used.
Yes, and speaking of the government making this information classified, I guess, unable to be examined, you took advantage of declassification in writing this book, but you talk about the fact that some information was sort of arbitrarily at one point available and then not available. I mean, even that area seemed to be mismanaged.
It's really a Kafka-esque system. We have way too many secrets in this country, and most of what is kept secret does not need to be kept secret. I obtained documents through the Freedom of Information Act in which large areas were blacked out. By comparing different documents and by interviewing people, I could get a sense of what had been blacked out. Again and again, almost always, what had been blacked out was censored, not to protect the national security, but to protect national security bureaucracies from embarrassment. And you're right, there were things that were released under the Freedom of Information Act about nuclear weapons before 9/11 that were then reclassified after 9/11. So it means you could be in possession of documents that you got from the government, but you would be in violation of the law because you'd have classified documents. It's just, it's absurd. And in the book, I write about weapons and weapons accidents that date back 50, 60 years. The Soviet Union no longer exists. We need access to this information. I did everything I could to make sure there's nothing in my book that threatens the national security. There's no information about nuclear weapons that would make it easier for someone to build one or threaten the United States. But in a democracy, we need to understand what the risks of this technology have been and the decisions that were made by presidents and their administrations and the weapons labs and the Air Force. And there's absolutely no reason why the American people shouldn't have access to this. So my source notes are extensive, and anyone who reads the book can ignore them, but I put them there on principle as an act of transparency. The book is not based on unnamed sources. It's based on interviews and on documents I've obtained. And if people want to know where I got the information, they can see where it comes from. And the government needs to do a much, much better job at releasing more information and being honest about the mistakes that were made and the near misses that we had, because it's through confronting that reality that we can avoid future danger.
As we look towards the future and avoiding danger, and we look back to some of the events in your book and the movement in the 80s to make known the dangers of these weapons and how that has died out, how would you see a movement now happening? I mean, how would that coalesce, so to speak? Do you know what
There was a nuclear freeze movement in the late 70s and early 80s, and people forget it was one of the most successful mass movements in America's history. Ronald Reagan took office as a very bellicose cold warrior, and he left office not only having created a friendship with Gorbachev, but Reagan was personally committed to abolishing nuclear weapons. I think he was sincere. He saw the film the day after, and it scared the hell out of him. But he was also a politician, and the biggest political protest in American history occurred in Central Park against nuclear weapons, for a nuclear freeze, 750,000 to 1 million people. There were protests across Western Europe with millions of people, and there was an awareness of the threat and a mass movement against the threat. And the mass movement was successful in the sense there were huge cutbacks in our arsenal. Since then, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, gave a wonderful speech in Prague in 2009 calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. But there's been no movement, no mass movement to support that. And there's no way that the President or other world leaders are going to feel under any pressure to take meaningful steps without a movement. So there are organizations like Global Zero and ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which are becoming more active on this issue. And my book is not, you know, a diatribe on behalf of either of those organizations. But if people care, and if people want to try to avoid this sort of catastrophe, there are definitely groups out there that are trying to raise awareness. And my book is certainly designed to try to raise awareness. I spent 6 years immersed in the details of nuclear weapons and the possibility of nuclear war and the studies precisely calculating how many weapons to use to kill the maximum number of civilians. And it didn't leave me apocalyptic or overwhelmed by doom. It just made me feel, you know, the most dangerous thing right now is complacency and a lack of awareness. And so that's what I'm here to talk about and try to get people to do something about this.
Yeah, I don't think you can read this book without thinking that you, as the author, must have just been immersed in this world.
Yeah.
Because there's so much and so many details and so many stories. So is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think is important to say as we wind down on this interview?
Yeah. You know, I write about a lot of dark subjects, and my next book is on prisons. I've written about the exploitation of illegal immigrants. I've written about the war on drugs, industrial agriculture. And I don't want people to feel overwhelmed by these problems. On the contrary, the reason I write about them, none of them were inevitable. Things don't have to be the way they are. In my own lifetime, I've seen enormous change for the better. When I was at college, there were just a handful of gay people who were out of the closet, and they were getting beaten up by the football players. So we have gay marriage now. When I was born, we had legal segregation. We have an African-American president now. And even in these bigger international realms, you know, when I was born, it was quite conceivable there'd be an all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union. But in my lifetime, I've seen the Berlin Wall come down, Germany reunited, Soviet Union vanished from the face of the earth, huge cutbacks in the number of nuclear weapons. But these things don't happen. They don't just happen. People have to make them happen. So I don't want readers or listeners to just feel this is an oppressive problem. These are solvable problems. And right now, the President of the United States really wants to address it. So I hope people will, you know, take that to heart and feel energized rather than overwhelmed.
Eric Schlosser, I really want to thank you for coming in and talking about this today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I have been speaking with journalist and author Eric Schlosser. We are talking about his latest book. It's called Command and Control, subtitle Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs.
We'll meet again.